Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, February 19th. I'll begin today's reading on the front page. Seeking answers. Break-in victim hit twice within 3 days. I was mad. From Urbana. Annoyance, anger, violation, vulnerability, resolve. Those are the feelings one Urbana burglary victim verbalized after his home was broken in and ransacked last month, and then was targeted again 72 hours later. He was on my bed. Yuck. Your own personal space. I had a glass of wine for lunch that day. Then I just started cleaning and putting everything back together. The News Gazette agreed not to reveal the identity of the South Urbana resident, Vic, so as not to make him a target again for other active burglars. Vic's story starts about 9 a.m. January 17th. Arriving home from work, he opened the overhead garage door but didn't pull his SUV in. In the garage, he noticed the door leading to his house was wide open. His initial thought was he left it that way, but figured that was unlikely given the snowy, cold conditions. Seconds later, still standing in his garage, he could see into the bathroom just inside the door. Cabinet doors were open and beach towels were thrown on the bathroom floor. I immediately exited the garage and called 911. They said you cannot go into your house. It was cold outside and I was standing in my driveway. Minutes later, officers converged. He understood they had to go in first to make sure there was no one inside. They checked the basement, even the crawl space. But it was more than 20 minutes before they let him in. They had an officer stand with him to ensure he stayed out. He needed to use the bathroom. When I walked in, they held my hand and said, "Don't step here or here." Throughout the bathroom, I saw evidence markers. Then I walked into my family room, and my laptop was gone, and I was mad. Confined to the family room while the officers worked, he could see into the kitchen and dining room. Drawers and cupboards were wide open. His checkbook, which had been in the kitchen drawer, was out. His pristine white cabinets were covered with black fingerprint powder. In the dining room, the burglar had rifled the antique china cabinet, which contained family heirlooms. Everything had been opened. There was fingerprint powder on the dark cabinet wood as well. The normally calm, positive Vic was building up a head of steam. I felt violated, vulnerable, and all those things that go through your head when your property is trashed. I was angry. From the spare bedroom, an officer called out to him that his laptop was on the bed with the cords wrapped around it. That made me feel better, but they still wouldn't let me go in the bedroom. Finally, after they had all the fingerprinting done and evidence markers all over, I went in the bedroom. I just kind of freaked out. He had not only opened all my drawers and thrown everything all over the floor and bed, he had emptied out my closet. He took my hung-up clothes and threw them all over the place. He knew he was walking on them, he said, disgusted at the image. As the officers worked, they eventually let Vic roam throughout his house. He found the burglar had dumped jewelry boxes in both bedrooms. On the kitchen counter near where his checkbook had been was where he kept his cell phone charger. That he took and stuck in his pocket, too, said Vic. In the basement, the intruder had moved, but not gotten in, a cube-shaped safe. Going back out to the garage, he found drawers to his tool bench opened, and his 19-year-old car had been entered. Sure enough, he had ransacked it, opened the console, dug out a bunch of stuff. The police have some of that stuff for fingerprints. That's when I noted the key was gone, and I was really mad. Vic said he always left just the car key in the ignition of his second vehicle for his own convenience. He doesn't do that anymore. He theorizes that the burglar planned to load up his car and leave with it when he heard Vic's garage door go up. I'm pretty sure I scared him off because he already had my car key in his pocket. He was going to take the laptop because it was on my bed, which is next to the driveway. Besides the mess, the burglar's only take was Vic's car key and cell phone charger. He estimated officers were in his house about 70 minutes collecting evidence. After their departure, Vic began his spring cleaning about 2 months early. I had to spend the whole day doing laundry, putting everything back together. All that fingerprint dust that is supposed to just wipe off, it didn't just wipe off. It took Formula 409 and a scrub pad to get it off the laminate. The antique china cabinet, which is dark wood, I could see dust on that. I had to keep wiping it down. I even went to the laundromat with my comforter and blankets. I knew that jerk had touched my bedding. Officers didn't have to tell Vic that his car key missing, the burglar was likely to return. The cops told me about other break-ins and car thefts. To rekey the ignition, he learned later, would cost $1,600, and with a $1,000 deductible on his homeowner's insurance, Vic figured that wasn't worth the investment for an 18-year-old car. Instead, he disabled the starter. Take that, burglar. His house in order, Vic went about his routine, hyper-aware that the intruder might return. On Saturday morning, January 20th, at 9:15, I came home from work, and I was walking in the garage, and I heard this loud, loud thump and bang sound. For a split second, I thought something had fallen. Then the next second, I knew exactly what was going on. I was peeved at this point. I ran in screaming and hollering, yelling and calling him all kinds of names, telling him not to come back. I hear him running off my wooden deck, slipping in leaves and ice and climbing over the fence to the west. That noise I heard was him breaking the locking mechanism on the patio door. That's when I started screaming and hollering. Had I walked on to my desk and looked to the west, I would have seen that jerk climbing my fence. The burglar had not gotten in, thanks to Vic's serendipitous timing. He said police followed the would-be burglar's prints through the snow, but the track ended at the street. They felt confident telling Vic that the footwear impressions were the same as they had seen around his house 3 days earlier. Vic, 68, described his neighborhood as a good mix of folks living in mostly owner-occupied modest bungalows. He calls his a fun little house. His next-door neighbor was broken into and ransacked also twice last August. Still, he refuses to lose sleep and look over his shoulder. I'm an old man. I have lived in this house 28 or 29 years. This is the first time this has ever happened to me. I cannot let the actions of other people control my life. I have no control over other people's actions. I have control over how I react to them. Also on the front page, rash of burglaries keeping police busy. Also from Urbana. Despite the arrest last week of a teen who admitted he broke into a home and stole a car, detectives have loads of work ahead to determine if he's working alone or is one of several burglars disrupting the peace of mind of South and East Urbana residents. With 52 residential burglaries citywide in 70 days since the 1st of December, police have been busy. Of that number, 35 have been in South Urbana, an area bordered by Illinois Avenue on the north, Lincoln Avenue on the east, Philo Road on the west, and Windsor Road on the south. In the same 3 months a year earlier, there were 29 residential burglaries in the south part of town. This is a labor-intensive process. You have to read all the reports together, take bits of this case, and compare them to bits from that case. That requires a detective with an eye for detail to compare all these different things, said Lieutenant Rich Searles, who heads up the Urbana Police Detective Division. It's a fact of life for detectives that the investigation of property crimes comes after crimes of violence against humans. On the third weekend in January, for example, a violent home invasion in which a man was shot and the armed robbery and shootings of three people at a house party refocused the attention of Urbana detectives from the spike in residential burglaries they were noticing in December and January. With arrests accomplished in both these cases, Searles has two detectives back at work on the residential burglaries and car thefts that emanated from them. Despite plenty of evidence collected from victims' homes, don't even think that the state crime lab can work at the speed that labs on television detective shows do. The state crime lab also has a triage system, cases with trial dates set take priority over those under investigation. Homicides trump burglaries. DNA analysis, for instance, the burglar who helps himself to a beverage while working and leaves a can with his slobber behind, can take longer than a fingerprint comparison. They are doing us a service by providing us that forensic analysis. They have finite resources. Things like fingerprints also take time. We are able to get prints back faster if we can ask them to compare collected prints to a possible suspect versus the situation where they have to compare latent prints against every print in the computer. Just like with any other investigation of serial crimes, it's not necessarily being committed by the same person. Some of these investigations we don't get a lot of evidence, others we do. One of the things we're doing is taking a fresh look at all the burglaries compared to each other and figuring out what pieces of evidence or information we can glean from one case that we can compare to another that might have more or different evidence so we can paint a much broader picture. We're investigating this collectively. It would be nice if you could just have a computer spit out the answer. A lot of times information can't be quantified. It's nuanced. For example, footwear patterns. The only way to compare them is to look at the photographs. While police are doing that work, they are begging citizens to remain vigilant and defensive. It's super, super important for folks to call us when they see suspicious activity. Police have received several reports, days after the fact, of someone walking through a backyard or ringing a doorbell with a solicitation. Hearing that days later simply doesn't help police much. Nobody should be walking through anyone's backyard. That in itself is reason to call police. Folks need to understand that it's better for us to investigate activity and find out it's legitimate than to miss an opportunity for us to catch somebody committing a burglary or stealing something. If you're not sure you should call the police, just call us and we'll sort it out. Also on the front page, vet got around even in deadly Afghan rain. Major Gene Richards walked through the rain but didn't get wet in Afghanistan. The rain includes small arms fire, mortar fire, IEDs, and even a helicopter crashing into his plywood and sandbag compound, Combat Outpost Fias. Richards, 47, is now an assistant professor of military science at the University of Illinois. The Shelbyville, Indiana native enlisted out of high school, but later earned two college degrees and has also taught at Clemson and Purdue. Richards served almost everywhere and in almost every capacity. In a 26-year career, he served in Germany, Africa, Korea, Honduras, and many other places. "I've been to every continent except Antarctica," says Richards, who enlisted in 1989 right out of high school. He spent over 6 years in military intelligence, where there was a lot of fulfillment. The Berlin Wall came down at that time. Richards earned the rank of staff sergeant, but before actually pinning on that rank, accepted a green to gold scholarship and attended Indiana University, receiving his degree in East Asian Studies. As an aviation branch officer and Black Hawk helicopter pilot in 2004, he served as company commander in the only forward-deployed theater aviation battalion in Honduras. The primary missions of Joint Task Force Bravo were to provide humanitarian assistance, disaster response, and counter-narcotics operations. Richard shuttled back and forth from assignments in Korea throughout his career. As a captain, he was assigned as an assistant professor at Clemson University and was named the National Defense Industrial Association's Army ROTC Instructor of the Year for 2006. Promoted to major in 2007, he then returned to Korea for yet another tour there, and first served as the Deputy Chief of 8th Army's G3 Aviation Division. Richards then served as Battalion Executive Officer for the U.S. Army's Korean Service Corps Battalion, with 2,000 Korean National Paramilitary Personnel. In my opinion, the Army's objective in Korea during that time was all about maintaining the status quo. In March 2011, it was time for Afghanistan and Operation Enduring Freedom. There he was part of a security force advisory team training Afghan National Security Forces. The International Security Assistance Force is led by U.S. forces, helping the Afghan government to develop the area while training Afghan security forces to provide their own security, including the Afghan National Police, the Afghan Border Police, and the Afghan National Army. Islamabad is the capital city of Kunar province, where the Pek River and Kunar River converge, a hotly contested area then. Though he always took orders readily, I wouldn't want to go back to Afghanistan. I could not assimilate with the Afghans. The country was one step out of the Stone Age. Mortar fire and IEDs were regular parts of his life. A road up the Pek River was known for its IEDs. 20 soldiers died from his unit during his deployment with the 3rd Brigade Combat Team of the 25th Infantry Division out of Schofield Barracks, Hawaii, though none of his small 7-man team. And then there was the helicopter crash. I heard an explosion, but not like a mortar round. I thought it was a suspected suicide bomber reported about earlier that morning. His command post covered in a cloud of dust, he and his team were the first to respond to the scene. The international crew of the Afghan Air Force Mi-17 helicopter, including a U.S. Air Force colonel, were all banged up and bloodied, but fortunately no one had been killed. The constant sound of explosions? You get kind of used to it, he said. But not all do. He knows PTSD is common among Afghanistan and Iraq veterans. Richards wears a wristband with 22 on it. Every day, 22 veterans take their lives. So besides teaching ROTC classes at UIUC, Richards has started a company called Modern Freedom Lifestyle in West Lafayette, Indiana, intended to help veterans by offering them jobs and business ownership opportunities. Windsor Road lot fits long-term needs. The Champaign School District said a recent $3.4 million purchase of property at 502 West Windsor Road is part of its long-term facility needs. The district finalized the purchase from Par 3 Development on February 12th. The purchase was prompted after the district made plans to relocate Dr. Howard Elementary School students and staff this summer to the Columbia Center at 1103 North Neal Street. Currently, Columbia houses some Unit 4 administrative services, including the Family Information Center, where the Schools of Choice Registration Center is. But with Dr. Howard's students and staff slated to occupy Columbia for the 2018-2019 and 2019-2020 school years, those services needed to be moved to a new location, according to Unit 4's Chief Financial and Legal Officer Tom Lockman. He said the district considered renting a temporary space for 2 years, but decided against it. While we could have looked to rent temporary space during that time to house the programmatic and administrative functions currently located at Columbia, we wanted to take advantage of the opportunity that this necessary relocation would present to thoughtfully considering our long-term facility needs. Lockman said that as the district considered accessibility issues as it moved forward with the referendum, it became clear that the district couldn't ensure the Columbia Center could be free of barriers to access. This is not possible at Columbia given its age and design. Acquisition of this property will give us the needed flexibility to best determine the most appropriate long-term use for Columbia once Dr. Howard returns to its new building. And from the sports page, Scrappy Doo, Illini hustle their way past the Huskers, from Champaign. A singular moment can define a season. Flip the narrative. Change expectations. The same can all hold true on a smaller scale in a single game. Illinois certainly experienced the latter Sunday afternoon against Nebraska, but perhaps with a moment that can have further-reaching implications as the season winds to an end. Plenty went into the Illini's 72-66 victory against the Cornhuskers. Laron Black scored a career high of 28 points. Trent Frazier and Mark Smith came through in the clutch with late-made free throws. Aaron Jordan provided long-sought-after rebounding from the wing. All well and good, but not the play, not the moment, that stood out to Illinois coach Brad Underwood. That came in a wild second-half scrum for a loose ball. Several Illini hit the floor trying to retain possession, with Smith in the middle of the play and Nebraska players flying at him the entire time. The ball ultimately popped into Frazier's hands. The freshman guard had the wherewithal to understand the shot clock had never reset. He had 2 seconds to get his shot off, a three-pointer that would have brought the house down in a sold-out State Farm Center that was building to a raucous crescendo. Frazier missed. Underwood called it the play of the night. That's everything, everything we have to be about. That wasn't one guy on the floor. It wasn't 2 guys on the floor. That was 3, 4 guys on the floor all fighting to win the game. You haven't seen that often. At least I haven't. I knew we were in great shape when we were to that point because then it's selfless. Then we were playing to win. That was awesome. Nebraska coach Tim Miles agreed. It was an amazing display of guys sacrificing their bodies and fighting for the same thing. It was just really a fantastic deal. Underwood has lauded his team's hustle throughout most of the season, with the only exception being the 25-point loss at Wisconsin and 22-point home loss to Penn State. Opposing coaches, without fail, regularly mention how hard Illinois plays. Their buy-in's good, and they're still playing hard. They're still competing, even with nothing to play for. I think that's a mark of good kids and the right leadership. But that loose ball, the one that the Illini scrapped for, was the type of peak effort and passion Underwood has been searching for this season. The Illinois coaching staff has spent the past week plus talking with the team about playing with the right kind of emotion, and the Illini were listening. We had that emotion, Illinois freshman guard Trent Frazier said. That one possession where everyone dove on the ball was incredible. If we come out here to fight every night like that, we're going to win. Illinois showed the type of emotion and effort after the second half started with what has become a standard Illini scoring drought. After both Black and Nichols were in double figures by halftime leading an efficient offense, Nebraska countered by double-teaming the post to cut off Illinois' most effective means of scoring. When they went on a 16-4 run and took the lead, it could have been here we go again. This team is starting to show its fight. That one play, multiple guys on the floor, that's a huge moment. That's the first time that resiliency, that many guys have played with that type of effort and that type of passion. Back to the front page from Tuscola, flu to blame for 8 local deaths this year. Illness also claimed life of young Douglas County woman. 8 people in Champaign County have died because of flu so far this year, according to the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. All 8 known cases were older adults who died in January, according to Public Health Administrator Julie Pride. Flu deaths are reported as flu pneumonia, she said, so it's unknown how many of the 8 deaths involved both. Pneumonia is one of the serious complications that can develop with flu. The number is based on what information the health district has now, but the actual number of flu deaths for the year could be higher and continue to grow. I need to remind people this flu season has not peaked, and it's not just older adults who are vulnerable to what's been a ravaging flu season. The Douglas County Coroner's Office this week released preliminary autopsy findings that identified the cause of death for Chantel Clark, a 24-year-old rural Tuscola mother of 2, as an unidentified flu strain and pneumonia. Douglas County Coroner Joe Victor said Ms. Clark died Wednesday at her home. She'd gone to a doctor in Monticello with flu and pneumonia symptoms the previous Friday, and a blood test was done. I can't believe that somebody sent her home. The death investigation is still in its early stages, and the coroner's office is still waiting on lab tests to identify the flu strain, but wanted to get the word out about the death as quickly as possible to warn people who haven't yet gotten flu shots. This death, that county's first flu death this year, struck a nerve. Whether Miss Clark had a flu shot is unknown, but we don't believe she did. Strains of both influenza A, including H3N2 and H1N1, and influenza B are circulating in this region. That's why Julie Pride and others are urging everyone who still hasn't gotten a flu shot to get one now. That advice applies even to those who have already been sick with the flu this season. People can get more than one strain, so if they have had the flu and they have not had the flu shot, it would still be a good idea to get the flu shot. Influenza isn't a required reportable communicable disease, but health departments can monitor the level of flu activity in their areas by the numbers of emergency room and convenient care visits tied to flu-like illness. Flu this season has reached the level of the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. Flu shots are still widely available through the health district, drugstores, and medical providers. The CU Public Health District accepts insurance for flu shots but doesn't turn anyone away who wants a shot but can't pay for it. The Douglas County Health Department has been giving free flu shots to all residents of that county since December. The flu shot has been about 36% effective this season, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's weekly morbidity and mortality report released on Friday. CDC continues to recommend influenza vaccination because the vaccine can still prevent some infections from currently circulating influenza viruses, which are expected to continue circulating for several weeks. Even with current vaccine effectiveness estimates, vaccination will still prevent influenza illness, including thousands of hospitalizations and deaths. Letter to the editor. Unit 4's building plan doesn't make sense. From the sounds of it, those in charge of the Champaign schools feel like the city belongs to them and that residents just need to get up and move out to wherever. The school board wants to redo Central High School, so instead of buying land on the outskirts of Champaign, board members feel it's their right to destroy historical properties near Central. The school district really should rethink this project because these homes have been there and owners shouldn't be pressured to sell out. How can taking the two homes on each side of one disputed property on West Church Street do anything for this new school? The district apparently plans to demolish the ones at 615 and 619 and leave the house at 617 alone. What will the school district do then? Put another parking lot on each side like they're going to do with the Burnham building? It sounds really stupid to me. The school board needs to build this new school somewhere else, not destroy the historical parts of Champaign. Larry Bloom, Champaign. Attacks on the chief are based on fallacies. First, the dictionary defines racism as the belief that one race is inferior to another. Love and admiration for Chief Illini Weck has nothing to do with such a belief. Thus, the accusation that the chief is a racist symbol or that the chief's supporters are racist is a monstrous lying libel. So the primary foundations of the anti-chief cause are based on monstrous lies and distortions. Is there any wonder that support for the chief continues? Such support will never die in the face of lies and distortions. Joel Carter, Moline. We'll take a short break now, then return with the second half of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, February 19th. Please stay tuned.